one has any better idea, but there have been questions about whether we should dissolve the platoon. You've seen the refugees in the hangar. Those are people we've found as we've been patrolling, who didn't have anywhere to go and were slowly starving to death. We're doing what we can, but we're pretty limited. In terms of local intel, there's nothing left that you could call a viable community for at least 1,000 miles from Yellowstone to the west, and up to 2,000 miles to the east and south. Beyond that, what we've been able to get indicates that citizens are closing their borders and hunkering down. Refugees have been shot and killed trying to get through barricades. I figure we'd have to go all the way to the east or west coast to have any chance of finding anywhere that would take us and our refugee group. We could force our way in somewhere, given our firepower, but that doesn't sit well with me. It wouldn't do anything but spread the misery. Oddly enough, we're likely better off right here, as long as the scavenging holds out. Which is why we're pretty pissed about your group beating us to everything. Lieutenant Collins straightened up and turned to face Bill squarely. Look, Bill, you tell a good story. I'm having a little trouble with it. I'd like to believe you, but you may simply be a good talker trying to work his way out of being shot. I'll have to discuss this with my staff. The lieutenant looked at his watch, then turned to Chavez and Stevenson. Take Mr. Rusted back to his room and make him comfortable, but make sure he stays put. 77. Retribution. Zeke was in his glory. He had complete control of the situation. He had one of the two bitches in his power. The dweeb that controlled the time machine stood in front of him, terrified. Looks like he's about to piss his pants. Zeke smirked in satisfaction.
The portal's in the shed, Kevin said, pointing.
Go get it. Bring them all.
We only have two, and the scavenging party has the other one.
Good, get it.
I can't move it on my own.
Oh, fuck me, you and you.
Zeke pointed to two somewhat more muscular men.
Help him move it out here.
It took only a few minutes, and the portal generator and gate were set up in the area in front of the thugs and their hostages. Kevin looked at Zeke, and at his nod turned on the portal. The gate faded into focus, showing the parking lot outside the warehouse, covered in damp, packed-down ash.
The fuck? Zeke snarled. You messing with me, pansy boy?
You've been away for a while, Kevin said. Yellowstone erupted. That's why we're here.
Carl looked at the ash on the other side and turned to Zeke.
Yeah, I remember back in Portland after Mount St. Helens. Same shit.
Zeke shrugged. He would take Carl's word for it, and it made little difference in the end. They were going home. A little ash for a few months wasn't going to be a big deal. Looking at Aaron, he said,
Now here's how it's going to work. You're going to walk through there, and if you or the dweeb give either of us any trouble, you'll both die right away. And then we'll take out as many of your friends as we can.
Zeke leered at her, his nastiest smile.
And later on, I'm going to teach you a lesson about manners, bitch.
He and Carl marched their hostages to the open gate. They stepped through, then Carl pushed his hostage to her knees, aimed at the portal generator through the open gate, and fired. There was a flash of sparks and the gate closed. Zeke and Carl paused to make sure that the gate stayed closed on their side. Then they looked around at the gray-brown landscape.
Looks a little different now, Zeke said. Still, good to be back.
He turned to Aaron.
Now, bitch, time to set the rules.
He grabbed her breast, put his face a few inches away from her, and snarled.
If you even think about trying anything, I'll fix it so you never walk again. Got me?
Carl watched all of this with interest, still towering over his hostage and holding her by the back of her collar. Suddenly there was a gunshot, and his head disintegrated in a spray of blood and brains.
The fuck?
Zeke yelled and spun around, attempting to drag Aaron with him to act as a human shield. Instead, Aaron went limp. Zeke was a large man, but he wasn't ready to support 140-odd pounds with one arm. Aaron dropped from his grasp. As she hit the ash-covered ground, there was another gunshot, and Zeke staggered backward. Aaron made spitting sounds and scrambled to get out of the way. There was another shot. Zeke felt the impact of the bullet. He felt no pain, but the shock drove him backward a few steps. There was a flicker of motion, and his gaze fixed on a short, curvy brunette with an assault rifle bearing down on him, her face glowing with rage. With an almost physical shock, he recognized her as the other bitch from the warehouse, the one that had nutted him. In an unintentional parody of the last encounter, he growled, "Fucking bitch," and raised his gun. There was another muzzle flash and he felt another impact. This one drove him back, and he staggered and sat down. Somehow he still managed to hold on to his gun, and he tried to bring it up again. The Angel of Death snarled at him,
"Burn in hell, motherfucker,"
and squeezed off another shot. Aaron watched in amazement as Monica advanced on Zeke, methodically firing away. Finally, Monica yelled something at the thug, shot him again, and he went over on his back. She walked up, looked down at his jerking body, and put three more quick shots into him. Aaron and the other girl got up and wiped themselves off. The other hostage was looking at Monica like she was 8 feet tall and green. Monica asked her if she was okay, and the girl wordlessly nodded. Monica came over to Aaron and put her arms around her. It was like a floodgate opening. Aaron started to sob, and before she knew it, she was shaking and crying. Monica held her and said something that Aaron couldn't make out. 78. In the news. This is BBC World Service. Today we present a global scorecard. The regions that have stopped broadcasting and with whom there are no dependable communications include the United States of America, Eastern Canada, Mexico, Central America, and the northern part of South America, Africa, except South Africa, the Middle East, except Iran and Iraq, China, parts of Southern Europe, Southeast Asia. And this just in. We have credible reports that North and South Korea have executed a nuclear exchange. MI6 says it has confirmed the events via satellite surveillance. No word on the amount of damage or casualties. 79. Negotiations. Richard peered through the pole cam gate at Bill's reclining form. "You're way too relaxed for a captured looter." Bill grinned back.
"I don't feel a firing squad in my immediate future. What's up?"
"Remember the thugs from the warehouse? Turns out they've survived in Outland. They just grabbed hostages and gated through to Earthside."
"Oh, for fuck's sake, does it ever stop?" Bill asked. "Is anyone doing anything?"
"Monica's gone after them. We'll know more soon."
"Well, she might finally get her wish to shoot someone."
"Probably. I gotta say, though, Bill, I'm a bit worried. We seem to be always on the edge of everything falling apart. It's like we're not big enough to damp down the chaos."
Bill laughed out loud. "You sound like a character from Jurassic Park."
Richard's only response was a sigh.
Okay, focus. I know. I think now is a good time for me to have another talk with the lieutenant. Listen, could you send someone back to Rivendell to get a big bag of my coffee?"
Richard looked at him in confusion.
"Are you shitting me?"
"Look, we want these guys on our side. The coffee will be both a peace offering and a statement that we have resources that they don't."
Richard thought about that for a second, then said,
"Done." He turned to Charlie. "Get Rivendell on the radio. Tell them to send Crazy Al over with a bag of nabob. Tell him it has to arrive undamaged, or we take away his dirt bike privileges. Again.
Charlie nodded and picked up the walkie-talkie, and Richard turned back to Bill.
So what's the end game?
I think having the guard as a part of Rivendell would be very good for us. Maybe they can help out with the shithead problem, too, if they start acting up.
Got it.
It took very little time before Crazy Al appeared, going at a speed that would have been nerve-wracking on pavement. On the prairie, he skipped from bump to bump, off the ground more often than touching it. The bike bounced back and forth from front to back wheel, but Al, up on the foot pegs, was steady as a rock. Crazy Al had been given that name for good reason. Back in the real world, he had been a motocross, enduro, stunt, dirt, and anything else biker. If it involved two wheels and an engine, Crazy Al was there. He was also the best mechanic they had, so they tolerated his habits with the condition that if he broke it, he had to fix it. But if a rush delivery was needed, he was their man. Al came in at full speed and hit the front binders. Doing a nose wheelie for the last 50 yards, he came to a precise stop in front of the group, pivoted on the front wheel, and touched down, facing back the way he'd come.
"What took you?" Richard said.
Al grinned, handed Richard his backpack, and left in a spray of dirt. Richard opened the backpack and took out a large foil bag of coffee. He motioned to Charlie, who opened the 6-foot gate. Richard handed the bag through to a waiting Bill, and they closed the gate.
80. Takeover. Adam Velichkov walked up to Justin Trench and Norm Winchester, trying to look as casual and unhurried as possible. He nudged Justin, who was swiveling his head to watch all sides.
"Geez, idiot, why don't you just wave a sign?"
"Line up, bro. These sheep wouldn't know what to do even if they noticed," Justin said.
"They'll notice soon enough," Adam replied. "We couldn't ask for a better opportunity. The entire GO, except for that wimpy brown kid, is off campus dealing with current events."
He looked at Norm.
"Everybody in place?"
Norm nodded and patted his pocket with a slight smile.
"Do it."
Norm reached into his pocket and withdrew a whistle, the kind typically used by referees and coaches. He put it to his lips and blew three quick notes. As people scattered throughout the lawn turned to look at the unexpected noise, Adam raised his rifle and began to speak in a loud voice.
"Ladies and gentlemen, we are pleased to announce a change in management, effective immediately. The so-called gate owners have demonstrated their inability to govern, so it falls on us to take over the reins. Naughty."
Adam waved his rifle at someone who had started toward the sheds.
"No, don't bother heading to the shed for weapons. We have control of that as well."
There were several scuffles in the immediate area. Adam grinned at Norm.
"Albertelli must have thought she was being real smart, but her guys are amateurs."
He waited until the erstwhile spies were pinned and disarmed, then looked around the crowd.
"Not to worry, folks. We're just cleaning up. A little bit of resistance won't be long. Now, here's what's going to happen."
Kevin blinked, staring down at the gun, pointed at his chest.
I don't have the keys. There is no scenario where I would ever need or want a gun.
The man holding the gun raised it to Kevin's head and opened his mouth to say something, but his companion held up his hand.
"I think he's telling the truth, Rob. From what I've overheard, this guy isn't involved in anything except the gates."
"Okay, just means we get to trade Kevin here for the keys." Rob waved his gun toward the open gate. "Close that."
"Monica is still Earthside," Kevin protested.
"Yes, that's the point. Adam told us to take Gunzilla out first. This works just as well."
Kevin hesitated, then raised the tablet in his hand and poked at it. The image in the gate faded out, leaving an inert ellipse of metal.
"Now," Rob said, "we're going to do inventory."
81. Contingency plans. Aaron looked at Monica, who was staring at a line of footprints that appeared out of nowhere and headed in the direction of the recent firefight.
No gate.
Monica glared at the offending patch of empty air.
Something's wrong. I wonder if Adam and his lowlife friends have picked this moment to pull something.
She turned to Aaron.
Everyone except Kevin is out of Rivendell right now. It would be the logical time to make a move.
Aaron stared at the footprints, then sighed.
Every time I think you and Bill are over-the-top crazy, someone moves the crazy. So now what? First, we should get out of the area in case they try to come after us. It won't take them long to realize they don't have access to the gun safes.
Matching actions to words, Monica wheeled and stalked off around the warehouse complex. Aaron and Susie, after a brief hesitation, followed. Aaron hurried to catch up.
You and Bill planned for this, right? Well, yeah. If you use the word plan loosely enough. We had an idea they might try something, but without specifics, all we could manage was basic strategies. Like, if they come across, it wouldn't take an Einstein to figure out that we own the closest warehouse unit to where the sheds were set up. So we've moved everything of value to another unit at the other end of the complex. That's where we're headed. But they still have all our guns,
Aaron protested. Monica turned and glared.
Sure, 'cause I never thought of that. Ah, what do they have? Rocks. Lots of gun safes filled with lots of rocks. It's turned into kind of a theme with us,
Monica grinned.
I hope they have a collective stroke when they finally open the safes.
Do they have the keys? Aaron asked.
No. So it'll take a while for them to either find some keys or figure out how to break the things open. We also removed all the tools that might normally be useful for burglary. Right now we have to get in touch with Richard and Matt, and Bill, if they've busted him out by now. What about Kevin? Assuming I'm right about what's going on, they'll need him to run the gates. Or they need to trade him for the keys to the gun safes. They won't harm him. And I made sure to comment about Kevin not having access to the guns within hearing of one of Adam's friends.
In a few minutes, they arrived at another warehouse unit. Monica pulled out a key and opened the side door, and they shuffled in. Monica hit a switch, and some low-level LED lighting illuminated the unit.
Bill set up some solar cells and car batteries. It's not ideal, but we weren't sure if the air would be clear enough to run a generator, if and when something went down, or if it would be a good idea to advertise our location with the noise.
Monica picked up a walkie-talkie with a red tag attached and turned it on. Pressing transmit, she spoke into it.
Richard, come in. We have a situation.
She released the button and waited.
Aren't you worried about Adam and friends listening in?
Aaron said.
No, I'm not that smart. That's why I'm not using an encrypted walkie-talkie that I put a red tag on for just this situation. Wow, you're cranky. Sorry, Aaron. I'm still angry over the thugs. I'll try not to bite your head off.
She jiggled the walkie-talkie for emphasis.
Richard and I arranged this. He and Matt each have one with the same code programmed in. He'll respond any second now.
The two women stared at the walkie-talkie, which remained stubbornly silent.
They are on Earthside. Give me a sec.
Monica grabbed a tablet and turned it on.
That's the portal software,
Aaron said, looking over Monica's shoulder.
But the thugs shot one of the gates, and Adam's group has the other one. What? Richard had stocked up enough spare parts so that Bill could put together another portal box, and we have the 3-foot gate, which nobody would miss because it's mostly useless for real work.
Aaron held up her hands in a fending off pose.
Okay, I give up. You guys obviously put a lot of thought into this. I'm going to just go with it.
Monica smiled at her friend, then climbed a ladder to a platform built above the kitchen area.
On the other hand, she called down to Aaron, my experience with the 3-foot gate has been all bad, so I'm not opening it up at ground level.
Aaron laughed, then fell silent as Monica began the same call sequence. In moments, she heard Richard's voice, tinny from the walkie-talkie speaker.
Which situation? So many possibilities.
Plan 9, Monica said. I think. We don't have confirmation yet. Call me back when you're on this side.
She scooted down the ladder and used the tablet to turn off the portal.
Plan 9?
Susie said. Aaron and Monica both turned in surprise. Susie hadn't said a word since the gunfight except to give her name, and Aaron had assumed she was in shock. Monica shrugged.
Movie reference. One of Bill's jokes. I'm surprised Richard went along with it. We don't actually have a lot of options until we have more information. Richard, Matt, and Charlie will cross to Earthside with the walkie-talkies so we can talk freely. Then we'll try to come up with a better plan. Meanwhile, we're going to dig in here, just in case Adam's group figures out where we are.
There was a crackle from the walkie-talkie, then Richard's voice came through. Monica?
Here.
We've located Bill, but he doesn't want to leave. They have a whole bunch of civilians, and they don't look like they're doing well. Bill thinks he may be able to recruit the guard and help those people, so for now, you're on your own.
Wonderful,
Monica muttered, then pressed the transmit button.
Got it. Look, Richard, we need intel in any case. We don't know how many people Adam has working with him, even assuming that's what's actually gone down. I'm just guessing at this point. We'll wait for night and use the goggles.
Be careful, he replied. Don't engage. We need to get all our ducks in a row before we hit back.
10-4. Out.
Monica put down the walkie-talkie.
Well, this sucks. I'm going to bring the portal down to ground level. Aaron, the night vision goggles should be over there on a shelf somewhere. Can you see if you can find them? Can I do anything?
Susie asked.
Yeah, grab this stuff as I hand it down. Be very careful with it, or we're stuck here.
Aaron scanned the shelves and quickly found the goggles, still boxed. She grabbed 3 boxes and some batteries. She also found, carefully laid out, a truly mind-boggling supply of weapons. Monica hadn't been kidding about rounding out their inventory, and Aaron wondered if even Richard knew the extent of that success. The armaments laid out on the racks would have made a SWAT team salivate.
Monica, what the heck is this, a sniper rifle?
A laugh drifted back through the warehouse.
All the girls have them. Goes with my shoes.
Aaron chuckled quietly and turned to go. Then she hesitated, grabbed a shotgun and some ammo, and headed back to the kitchenette.
Listen,
Susie said.
I have no clue about guns. Don't worry about it, sunshine.
Monica gave Susie a slap on the shoulder that almost knocked her over.
You're our Kevin. You'll be running the portal. Aaron and I will be shooting bad guys. Richard said, Richard ain't here, Aaron. I'm not saying we're going to, but I'm not saying we aren't.
Aaron shook her head. Monica's bloodthirsty attitude had always seemed to be just that, tood. Now, after the episode with the thugs, Aaron was viewing all that past commentary through a new lens.
Turns out my best friend is a bit of a psycho. Well, it could be worse, I guess. Maybe. So what's the plan?
She asked.
This warehouse unit is outside the Rivendell fence. We made sure of that. We'll use the 3-foot gate after nightfall to reconnoiter. At minimum, we need to figure out the strategic situation. I'd love to get one of those motherfuckers in my crosshairs, but honestly, Richard is right. Once we hit one of them, the rest will go into defensive mode, and I wouldn't put it past them to use other students as human shields.
The lights had been turned off in the warehouse. The gate lay flat on the concrete floor, prairie grass from the outland side sticking up through the circle of metal. Aaron looked at Monica and Susie, each of whom was wearing the same night vision goggles as herself. The goggles gave them a vaguely insectile appearance.
I'm ready.
Susie adjusted her grip on the gate.
Good.
Monica lay down on her stomach beside Aaron.
Now, slowly raise the edge of the gate until I say stop.
Susie complied, and within seconds Monica and Aaron were able to look through the small, raised section of gate and see the Rivendell fence and numerous tents that made up the living quarters for most of the residents.
No obvious guards. In fact, no guards, not even the ones who normally guard the fence at night. Odd.
Monica deliberated silently for a few seconds, then added,
I'm going through. No, I will.
Monica turned to Aaron.
Why, that makes no sense. Sure it does. I'll go through and try to talk to someone. I can do that as well as you can. If I get caught or shot at, you kill everyone. You're way better at that than I am.
Monica smiled, visible with the night vision goggles.
Okay, that actually does make sense. Very well, Buttercup, off you go.
Aaron found herself less pleased with winning the argument than expected. Gathering her resolve, she crawled commando style through the partially raised gate. It took several minutes of crawling with the shotgun strapped across her back to get to the fence. The grass would rustle too much if she tried to push her pace. Monica was watching from the warehouse, of course, but Aaron still found herself scanning every few seconds for approaching wildlife. Not that there was likely to be any. Most of the smart predators had figured out that hanging around the fence was fatal. The dumb ones, well, Darwining was definitely a thing. Finally, Aaron found herself up against the fence. She moved sideways until she was close to a tent.
Psst.
No response. Aaron threw a pebble against the side of the tent. A head appeared out the tent flap and looked around.
Psst.
The occupant stepped carefully out of the tent. Aaron recognized her as someone she'd seen around but couldn't attach a name. She raised the goggles to her forehead. The woman moved to the fence and crouched down.
So you are still alive. Adam and his friends have a reward out for any of the GO.
So it really was Adam. It wasn't quite a relief to have it confirmed, but Aaron felt a sense of something like satisfaction from knowing for sure.
Paid in what, Deutschmarks?
Aaron heard a low chuckle.
Privileges, extra food, maybe a promotion to management, as they put it. Gonna collect?
The woman made a snorting sound.
Yeah, because I want to be part of that group of morons. Those fuck-ups think they're big shots because they have the guns right now. They recruited some other fuck-ups and now they all fancy themselves kings of the shit pile. There are about a dozen of them, but they'll need more than that to keep control. You should have heard them arguing tonight about who was going to sleep and who was going to guard the serfs. That's the rest of us, of course.
Serfs? Aaron asked.
Not exactly the word they used, but it's pretty obvious this will be a stratified society, if they get their way. Yeah, no one stages a coup in a free society so they can implement another free society.
The woman grinned.
I'm Joy, by the way. Susie is my friend. Is she okay? She's fine. More than I can say for the thugs who grabbed us. Good. Tell Susie Joy says hi.
Aaron nodded, unsure if Joy could see the motion.
What's their deployment?
The fuck-ups?
They have four morons at a time guarding. Of course, they're guarding against us more than against wildlife. The rest of them are sleeping in the west shed. No one else is allowed in either shed on pain of death. Seriously? Death? Well, that's what they say.
Joy answered.
That Adam piece of shit, though. I think he'd do it. Most of the rest, not so much. They're just playing at big shot.
Motion along the fence caught Aaron's eye.
I think someone's coming. Do they walk around on guard duty? I guess they do. I have to get back in my tent until he's gone past.
Joy disappeared, and Aaron carefully backed up 10 yards or so. As she watched through her night vision goggles, the man walked slowly along the fence carrying an AR-15. Aaron couldn't shake the feeling that he could see her as well as she could see him, but, of course, without goggles, that was not possible. The guard having passed, Aaron met Joy at the fence again.
Have they gotten into the gun safes yet?
Joy shook her head.
No, but not for lack of trying. Those are some solid boxes you guys have. They were looking for a wedge and sledge. I'm pretty sure that's what they said, but couldn't find one. Actually, they were complaining that there was a lot of stuff missing. Adam was screaming at everyone and threatening to start shooting people. The guy is seriously deranged. Anyway, I think they're going to try a swap now. Kevin for the keys, but first they have to find you. They know Richard and Bill are out in the field, although they won't know Bill's status. We've gone radio silent, so they won't have any more info. We can maintain silence. I overheard them talking. Some of them want to take the ultralight up, find out where your group is, then drop a few of Kevin's fingers down to them. Or if they can get communications with you, they'll hurt him on the air, then make demands. These guys are seriously wackadoodle. Thanks, Joy. We're making plans, but it may take a few days. Hang in there. You can't just start shooting them through your gate? As you said, they'll hurt Kevin. They also might start shooting people randomly, sort of an eye for an eye thing. We have to take them all out at once, and I'm not sure yet how we're going to do that. Got it. I'll keep my ears open. Come by any time for updates. Thanks, Joy. See you later.
Erin backed away from the fence until she was close to where she thought the gate would be. Hist, and a sliver of goggle glow through the gate helped her zero in. In seconds, she was back in the warehouse. Susie turned off the gate at a command from Monica, then turned on the lights.
Well,
Monica said.
Guys with guns, led by Adam, about a dozen. They've got Kevin, and Adam is apparently crazy enough to hurt or even kill people. At least to hear him talk. This will have to be a surgical strike.
Erin shook her head.
I can't believe I just said that. Get used to it, Buttercup. It's a new world now.
82. Counterpoint. August 13th. Bill looked up as the poll cam faded in.
Is this a social call?
Nope. It's just one thing after another back in Rivendell, Richard said. The shitheads we were worried might try something, tried something. They've basically taken over the camp at gunpoint.
Well, that's stupid. Now they'll have to constantly guard everyone.
No one has accused Adam and his friends of being smart. Nasty and moronic is more their speed.
Okay, we have most of the weapons, though.
And they have a camp full of hostages, including Kevin. He was the only GO member in town because of everything else that's happening, which probably explains their timing.
Great. Well, there's not much more I can do at this point. I have another interview scheduled for this morning. Maybe if they take too long to come for me, I'll get you to gate me into the lieutenant's office.
And get yourself shot?
Probably not. But things have hit the fan. We need to turn up the heat.
Richard nodded and motioned for the gate to be closed.
Good morning, honored guest. Rise and shine.
Bill opened one bleary eye to see Corporal Chavez glaring down at him. She was obviously enjoying this. Block, parry, riposte. Bill sat up, reached under the hard wooden bench on which he'd barely slept. Chavez stepped back while reaching for her sidearm, and pulled out a large foil bag prominently labeled Nabob Full City Dark. He handed it to her and said,
"Give this to your boss. Let me know when coffee is ready."
He smiled as innocently as possible and laid back down. Out of the corner of his eye, he could see Chavez staring at the bag in her hand. The guard at the door was also staring. Bill was pretty sure he could have walked right out and no one would have noticed. Chavez turned and, with the bag held out in front of her like a live bomb, walked slowly out the door. The guard closed the door without once looking at Bill.
Game, set, match,
he thought with satisfaction, and closed his eyes. There was a knock, and Corporal Chavez opened the door.
When you're ready, the lieutenant would like to see you.
Ready now,
Bill replied and stood up.
Much better.
When they got to Lieutenant Collins's office, he was sitting in his desk chair, slumped back, slowly sipping coffee. The expression on his face said, in a way no words could, that this was not the same crap as yesterday. Stevenson stood near the desk, holding a cup as well. He looked almost afraid to taste it. Chavez saluted the lieutenant and made a beeline for the coffee pot. She poured one for Bill, one for herself, and indicated to the guard that he should help himself. The look on the guard's face said he'd marry her right there.
"I gave the rest of the coffee to the troops," Lieutenant Collins said. "Right now, if you ran for president, they'd all vote for you."
Bill grinned.
"Same thing I do every night, try to take over the world."
The lieutenant sighed.
"I'm not even going to ask about the reference, I mean. The coffee I will ask about, starting with, is there more?"
"Crap tons," Bill said. "As I've said on more than one occasion, I live not only for coffee, but on coffee. Plus we have the loot, salvaged merchandise from the Walgreens, if you just want regular coffee."
"Okay, Bill. I haven't missed that you getting the coffee means you could have left by the same method, so I'm prepared to negotiate seriously. What are you looking for?"
Well, we do have an immediate situation with some jerks who've taken over Rivendell and have crowned themselves kings or barons or something. We could use some help with that. Other than that, we don't really have anything in the way of demands. Most of us would prefer to go back to the way things used to be. Failing that, we just want to survive and save as many other people as we can find.
"Do you still consider yourselves part of America?"
Lieutenant Collins asked.
"Until someone tells us different. We're not trying to secede, if that's what you mean. But it also doesn't mean we want to limit rescue to Americans. If we can get to the citizens of any other countries, that's good too."
"What about coming back to this side, if and when?"
Bill considered his options, then decided to go with a blunt appraisal.
"Best case, everything clears up, the weather washes most of the ash away, and ecosystems aren't too badly damaged. We'd still be faced with a social and technological breakdown a couple of years deep. Our geology major gave us our guess that up to half the global population will be dead before we dig ourselves out."
Lieutenant Collins didn't look surprised at this statement. Slightly encouraged, Bill continued.
"Worst case, the climate doesn't recover for decades. We end up with sub-Arctic tundra and bogs down to the tropics. In that case, we could be back to pre-industrial era populations. We might be able to come back within our lifetimes, but I'm not going to depend on it, and I'm certainly not willing to push it."
The lieutenant nodded slowly.
"We have a geologist in the refugee group, and he said something very similar."
He hesitated.
"I'm going to make this optional for the troops. They can have an honorable discharge effective immediately, or they can continue to serve. If they choose the latter, we'll be on indefinite detached duty, protecting what could end up being the last known outpost of America. Until and unless we find others, then it's up for renegotiation. Good?"
Bill smiled.
"Good. I don't think we'll need a general vote since we've always taken in anyone we find, but you'll want to confirm your status with the planning committee."
"Good enough. So how do we proceed?"
Richard's voice came from a camera suspended in the air in the corner of the room.
"First thing we need to do is get rid of Adam and his squad."
Lieutenant Collins jerked as he spotted the small circle of differently colored air with a camera hanging in the middle.
"Impressive. It's been theoretical until now. That's how they found you?"
Bill noticed that Private Stevenson was grinning from ear to ear.
"Some people just get it."
Richard continued.
"We'll bow to your expertise, of course, in getting rid of the infestation, but the first step is to get into the immediate area. If you have the vehicles, you can drive to our warehouse on this side, then we'll get you across. After that, it's up to you."
Collins turned to Chavez.
"Corporal, see to it."
He turned back to Bill.
"We have some personnel with sniper experience. This sounds like a situation where deadly force is justified."
Keep in mind that they effectively have a town full of hostages, including our friend Kevin, who is the only person who really understands the gates. Chavez showed her teeth.
Leave it to us. These guys sound like they need killing.
Bill's eyebrows went up.
Geez, you remind me of someone.
Once a decision had been made, the guard wasted no time getting ready. In short order, they had a caravan assembled, which consisted of three Hummers with mounted machine guns. Bill pointed at the ordnance.
Kind of heavily armed for disaster management, aren't you?
Lieutenant Collins laughed. Those are Army units. There's a whole story behind how we ended up with them. Maybe sometime I'll tell you how I spent my summer vacation. The lieutenant paused to look back at the hangar. We've got some personnel carriers for the refugees. The staff I've left behind will organize them for transfer to your warehouse address as soon as we give the all clear. I don't want them anywhere near the action until it's over, though. Bill nodded and climbed into the lead Hummer with the lieutenant. The trip was uneventful. Even if there had been legions of looters patrolling downtown Lincoln, they wouldn't have wanted to tangle with a fully armed and equipped National Guard platoon. In very little time, they arrived at the address that Bill had specified. They stopped the caravan, and Bill, Lieutenant Collins, and Corporal Chavez got out. The first thing Bill noticed were two corpses lying in the ash. From the look of them, they'd been there for about a day. The manner of death was graphically obvious, especially in the case of the one missing half his head. Lieutenant Collins looked at Bill and raised an eyebrow in silent inquiry. Bill swallowed to try to calm his heaving stomach, then looked away.
I recognize those assholes. I knew they were back, but I'm not sure how they ended up dead on the street. My money's on Monica.
Chavez raised her rifle as three people came around one of the buildings.
It's okay, Corporal, Bill said. They're with us.
Hey, Sunshine,
Monica called.
Brought a party, did you?
Bill gestured to the corpses without looking directly at them.
Looks to me like you had one of your own. What happened?
Monica glanced aside at Aaron and the third girl. Bill recognized her as the blonde, who had seemed very interested in Richard.
It's a long story, Bill, but these cretins apparently survived in Outland for a while. They killed Pete and Phil and took Aaron and Susie hostage. Fuckers needed shooting.
Collins stepped forward.
These aren't part of the group that's holding Rivendell right now?
And as an aside to Bill,
this is who Chavez reminds you of?
No, different group,
Monica said.
Seems like all the cockroaches decided to come out at the same time. So I understand you have some of these interdimensional gates that we can use for recon?
Chavez asked. Monica tilted her head toward the warehouse.
Yep, come on. I'll show you our hoard.
Remember, Corporal, Collins said. No night vision assets, so we'll have to do this the hard way.
Bill and Monica laughed in sync.
Got that covered, too, Bill said.
83. Counter-Strike. Collins was sitting down with a coffee when Chavez came into the kitchenette. She drew a cup and sat down across from him. There was silence as she took a slow, appreciative sip.
I can't quite figure these people out,
Chavez said.
They don't have the jingoistic chest-thumping attitude of preppers, but holy God, do they have inventory. Puts us to shame, honestly.
This Albertelli woman sounds kind of prepperish.
Yes and no.
Chavez paused to take another sip, then looked at the cup.
Damn, I could get used to this. Anyway, Monica is a product of an almost all-male household. Remind you of anyone?
She grinned at the lieutenant, and he chuckled.
So she's learned to behave aggressively. Always pushback, always payback. But she doesn't really have the paranoid streak you need to make a good prepper.
Rustad has that, Collins said.
Yeah, but for all the wrong reasons. To him, it's a great big LARP campaign. I don't think he even really believed we might shoot him when we were holding him. Nice guy, but he's going to get a wake-up call someday, and it's going to hurt.
Collins was silent for a moment as he considered his coffee.
B, these people are organized and well-supplied. I'm amazed at the level of preparedness, but as you say, no real-world experience. He looked at her over his cup. I'm not prepared to write off the USA just yet, but in terms of hunkering down for a while, I don't think we're going to find better.
Agreed, sir. But with who in charge? Are we going to walk in and take over?
Let's not borrow trouble yet. Take care of the immediate problem, then we'll see if they have an overall organization that I'm comfortable with. And on that subject, what do we have?
Well, good news. They have night vision equipment, so a night op is possible. Bad news? They don't have enough gates for us to move in with a surgical strike. Intel from Albertelli and Savard says the hostiles are too spread out to take out all at once with a single squad, so we'll need to cross over, move into positions while maintaining radio discipline, and hit in a coordinated fashion. Albertelli's opinion of the head creep is that he'll shoot civilians out of spite if he knows he's under attack.
Got it. Do we have enough personnel to cover this?
Not experienced ones. We've got a couple of snipers for the outside guards, a couple of others who've been blooded, but most of our troops,
she shrugged,
part-timers.
Suggestions?
Well, Monica, Albertelli wants to help.
A civilian? No way.
Seriously, sir. She just finished taking down two bad actors who kidnapped her friends. She's past the freezing stage.
How's her marksmanship?
According to her friends, scary good. And we really could use an embedded local to help sort it out if things go hinky.
Okay, Chavez. Last resort, and only in a minimal exposure situation, and if we have to go in hot, she steps back. Make sure she understands that.
Understood, sir.
Chavez opened a notebook.
Now, deployments. Here's the layout.
Bill unplugged the cable from the portal box, and the view through the 8-inch gate wavered and died.
Okay, we're clear.
After removing the night vision goggles from his face, he pulled the tablet from the carrying case and poked at the control app. The glow from the screen lit up the darkness of the warehouse parking lot.
And properly shut down.
Chavez removed her night vision goggles and turned on a flashlight.
Four hostiles, two hostages in the shed. One is your friend Kevin, I think. This will require coordination. And both of the 6-foot gates.
Which means we have to send the other squad through first, then move the gates, said Bill.
This is getting complicated.
Monica punched Bill in the shoulder.
Piece of cake, sunshine. Monica.
Monica gave Chavez a glance.
I know, B. I'll take it seriously. Promise.
Chavez glared back, then let her expression soften.
I think you showing up will have some psychological advantage. Otherwise, I'd put you on the sniper team. But I'll pull you entirely if you give me reason to be nervous. Got it. No grandstanding.
The two women smiled at each other and Bill rolled his eyes.
Jeez, get a room.
Ouch!
Monica spared him an evil smile as she withdrew the fist. Schmidt couldn't help the occasional swagger as he walked the perimeter. The sheeple were all in their tents per orders from management. He grinned to himself. Who would have guessed that an exploding volcano would usher in a chance to be a king? Well, okay, it was a pretty common post-apocalyptic theme. It was even discussed on the autonomist and revolutionary forums. What kinds of takeover would work best in different scenarios, and this was textbook. Almost, anyway. They could use a few more bodies in management. Maybe after another week or two of being labor, more people would decide to request a promotion. A noise, just outside the fence. Probably some stupid prehistoric animal, not smart enough to avoid the new top predators. Schmidt turned and pulled his flashlight out of his pocket, just as there was a pop. Calhoun paused, his hand not quite on his flashlight. That had sounded like a shot from a silenced rifle. Why would...
4, 3, 2...
Chavez counted down, staring at her watch. As she reached 0, Charlie and Bill both hit the OK buttons on their respective tablets.
As the gates shimmered into life, Monica and several soldiers jumped through, quickly followed by shouted orders to freeze, get down, drop weapons. One of the hostiles raised his rifle. There was a low crack, and he crumpled. As Chavez swiveled, evaluating the situation, another one of them grabbed a woman in a headlock and put his gun to her head. He quickly backed up against a palleted stack of boxes.
"Back off! I will blow her head off!"
He was talking, not shooting, so Chavez took the time to finish her sweep. The two remaining hostiles had not dropped their weapons, but had them pointed down, maybe waiting to see which way the wind blew, but one of them was also pointed at the hostage on the ground. She briefly considered just blowing them away regardless, but reminded herself that that was the difference between a peacekeeper and a mercenary. She wouldn't step over that line. Plus, it might cause the hostage taker to retaliate. Monica stepped up.
"Well, hello, Adam. Time for that orchidectomy I promised you."
"Fuck off, bitch. You can't get behind me. You try to shoot me, you'll have to go through this, bitch."
"Do you know any other words, Adam? Bitch gets a little old after a while. Maybe try to shake it up a little."
"Fuck off, bitch,"
Monica sneered at him.
"You really are a mouth-breathing moron."
Bill had heard everything through the still-open gate. This was possibly the worst-case scenario, a hostage situation. One twitch by the wrong person, and everyone would start shooting. He looked around frantically, hoping for inspiration. Then he spotted the pole cam. It was true that he couldn't get behind Adam, but Adam was a two-dimensional thinker. Bill grabbed the pole cam. He quickly pulled the various antennae back from the gate, leaving only the camera within the circle. Pointing to one of the soldiers, he said,
"Get one of your high-powered flashlights, bring it over, and be prepared to turn it on in someone's face."
The soldier quickly complied, while Bill raised the pole cam into the air about 10 feet up, with the camera pointing downward. He juggled the pole and the tablet until one of the soldiers came over and took the tablet.
"Press OK," Bill instructed him.
The interface shimmered to life inside the gate's circumference. Bill moved the pole cam slightly, then with an abrupt motion, slammed it straight downward. There was a crack, followed by an "Ow, fuck!" as the camera separated from the pole cam and sailed into the air. Hanging in midair at exactly eye level, a disembodied head stuck out of the top of the pole cam gate.
"Now, in his eyes!" Bill yelled.
The soldier reacted immediately, shining the flashlight straight into Adam's face. Bill grinned.
"Hello, Adam. How's tricks?"
Chavez was sidling slowly to the side, hoping to get a useful angle, when Adam's head abruptly disappeared. There was an "Ow, fuck!" as the headless body of Adam reached up frantically to where his head should be, dropping the rifle and releasing the hostage in the process. Chavez grabbed the weapon while another soldier pulled the hostage away. The two remaining hostiles, having determined the direction of the wind, dropped their rifles and put their hands on their heads. Monica muttered something that sounded like,
"Nice one, Bill,"
strode up to Adam and punched him in the solar plexus. He went down, his head popping out from an apparent hole in the air. While Monica placed the barrel of her gun against Adam's temple, Chavez stepped forward and looked up through the hole. Just before it disappeared, she clearly saw the overcast night sky of Nebraska.
"Memo to self, don't ever underestimate this Bill guy."
Bill walked through the 6-foot gate and looked around. Kevin was still on the floor, covering his head. Bill reached a hand down.
"It's okay, Kevin, we're in charge now."
As Kevin slowly levered himself off the ground, Bill finished his scan. One asshole was dead on the floor, and three more were standing with hands on their heads, staring at gun barrels. In Adam's case, the gun barrel led back along the rifle to Monica's grinning face. Bill admitted to a small bit of surprise that Adam was still alive. The woman was definitely wound a little tight.
"Yeah, I'm in love."
84. Aftermath.
August 15th. The truck gate opened up, showing Lieutenant Collins and Corporal Chavez earthside with a row of military vehicles behind them. Aaron and Richard walked through from Outland with a couple of men trailing them holding weapons. The troops looked around and took up guard positions. Introductions were made, and Richard said,
"Thought you might want to come across and have a quick look, then we'll see about getting your vehicles placed."
Collins walked back through the gate with Aaron and Richard. The lieutenant staggered a bit as he stepped through, as if he'd been bracing for something that turned out not to be there. Chavez, right behind them, chuckled.
"Stevenson is probably peeing himself with excitement."
Collins swept his gaze over the colony, and Aaron smiled as she copied his actions, trying to see it with fresh eyes. A sea of tents, large and small, occupied a large, fenced area, with no discernible organization. Residents were scattered around, some working on tasks, some just enjoying the sunny day. In the distance, ranch-style fencing had been put up for cattle, sheep, and horses. Near at hand, people were getting up from whatever they had been doing and coming over to Rubberneck. The buzz of conversation rose steadily in volume. Some adjustments were necessary to make room for the refugees and military personnel. Tents had to be moved. In a couple of cases, campers had set up small green spaces in front of their tents, which had to be given up. But the guard personnel were quick and efficient. In no time, accommodations were up for the new residents. Along with many others, Aaron was doing a bit of rubbernecking when a familiar face caught her eye.
"Oh my God, Professor Collins!" she yelled and rushed over.
Just in time, she noticed a woman and two adolescents standing near the professor, so she aborted the intended bear hug, instead grabbing his hand as she reached him.
"Yellowstone erupted, and it blew more than 700 cubic miles of ash into the air, and on this side, it blew sometime in the last 100,000 years, and that's what killed off humans over here, and I think it left Nebraska with more hills and a higher ground level, and the climate is cooler and wetter here, and I don't know if that's global warming, and without people, the Pleistocene animals aren't extinct."
Aaron stopped and took a large breath. Professor Collins smiled at her and said,
"We'll go over that in detail later, I think. I'm glad to see you alive and well."
Aaron smiled back timidly and turned to the woman beside Professor Collins.
"I'm Aaron. I'm one of his students."
The woman returned a friendly smile.
"So I gathered. I'm Mary."
The two shook hands. Aaron turned back to Professor Collins.
"So how did you end up in the National Guard refugee camp?"
The professor gave an embarrassed chuckle.
"You'd think I'd know better than to stay in town, wouldn't you?"
he shrugged.
"But it took too long to gather my family together, and by the time we were ready to head out, everything was gridlocked. We stayed home until the ashfall stopped, with the intention of trying to get out of town then. But who should show up on my doorstep but my little brother in a big Hummer?"
Aaron was blank for a two count, then,
"Lieutenant Collins, duh!"
"Yep. Always good to have connections in the military. So how did you end up here?"
Aaron looked down for a moment and considered where to begin. 85. Redux. August 16th.
"There will be a memorial for Pete and Phil this afternoon. Scouts have found as much of their remains as they are likely to."
Richard looked around the table. Expressions ranged from unhappy to angry.
"I guess we need a cemetery now."
"Maybe we should bring the thugs' corpses through to Outland and leave them out for the scavengers,"
Monica suggested.
"As an ironic justice kind of thing, sure as hell I'm not interested in burying them."
"No one is, Monica. I just question if it's worth the effort. On the other hand, Krista thinks leaving them in the parking lot is even worse, disease-wise, so go ahead, organize it if you want."
Richard waited for more comments, then gestured to Lieutenant Collins, who was seated at the table, and said,
"We're going to be having some in-depth discussions with the lieutenant once the guard is settled in about government, law enforcement, and
what to do with our failed revolutionaries. A firing squad being unlikely, we have to decide if we want to build a jail, exile them, or put them to work in leg irons for a few years. Collins leaned forward. This isn't time critical, so it's better to get it right than to make a fast decision. Much harder to change direction later. For the moment, the guard will take charge of the prisoners. There are latrines to dig and vehicles to wash, and my troops will be happy for the help. He gestured to Monica. We don't do law enforcement, though, so you should probably vote your sheriff pro tem into a permanent position. I should also mention that my corporal has requested a discharge and will be joining your police department. Bill started humming the Jaws theme, and Monica laughed. Richard nodded and swept the table with his gaze, signaling a change of subject. On a happier note, I guess you've all heard the news. One of our scouting group got another of our scouting group pregnant. First of many, probably.
Correct. As it turns out, I've had a couple of other women report that they're late. We may be setting up for a baby boom next spring.
Krista looked down at her hands.
I'm going to have to make sure I'm ready for it. Matt, I'll be updating my list. Beware.
Matt groaned theatrically and made as if to get up and leave.
How much of a problem is it? Or is it a problem?
Richard said.
Well, medically, yes. In about 8 months it will be, Krista replied. Before modern medicine, up to 50% of newborns didn't survive past 3 months of age. We'll beat that statistic, of course, because we know about sanitation, but we'll be nowhere near the 0.6% we're used to in the modern world, not without some help. A lot of the supplies I'll need will be in the University Health Center.
If I could get the plumbing supplies from the Home Depot, Bill said, we'd have clean water.
If we could go find a couple more vehicles, Matt added, we could do several of these important things at once.
Actually, we can help you out there since we have these army trucks sitting around now, Lieutenant Collins pointed out. But it would be handy to have fuel storage tanks on this side.
Which would also be very handy, Dick said, for getting us construction supplies for those buildings for the winter.
And I remind you, gentlemen, Anita said, that we still have to break ground before fall if you want spring wheat.
Richard put his head in his hands.
I quit.
Bill and Richard stood outside, surrounded by tables and stands covered with equipment, parts, and tools. Bill had two wind turbines up on stands. The turbines were slowly turning in a breeze that Richard admitted to himself didn't seem strong enough to move anything. Bill watched his handiwork with obvious pride for a moment, then turned to the measuring instruments on the table. They had gathered a lot of equipment from one of those sustainable energy supply stores, most notably a large number of storage batteries and a charging system to buffer the generator output. The store had also contained a stack of solar panels, which were now leaning against the south side of one of the sheds.
We'll put the solar panels on top of the sheds and add their output to the grid when we have time, he said, as much to himself as to Richard.
Richard stood there and waited. Bill would get there when he got there. And meanwhile, Richard was content to let the day wash over him. The sun was shining. Amazing, the weather on this side, and felt good warming his face. He'd had an unexpectedly good time today at breakfast when he ended up seated beside a girl named Susie. She had told a fascinating tale of kidnap, revenge, and military night ops. Susie was bright, interesting, and didn't kill people. Richard felt a little ashamed of himself, but he had to admit that his budding interest in Monica hadn't survived her display of bloodthirstiness. Bill was welcome to her. Or possibly Chavez, it was hard to tell with Monica. And for maybe the first time since he was 8 years old, Richard felt at home. He had people whom he considered friends, whom he would trust with his life. As far as he was concerned, Earthside could go jump. Meanwhile, Bill's monologue seemed to be running down. Richard started paying more attention.
There's a pretty steady breeze from the west most days, and on balance it seems to be enough for us when we're not running too much equipment, with a little left over to keep the batteries charged. The solar cells will add to that, and of course we can always add more turbines.
So, we have full-time electricity then? Richard said.
For now. This is where I go on my rant again about becoming self-sufficient. We can't rely on scavenging indefinitely, and once replacement parts become scarce, some of our tech won't be sustainable.
Yep, got it. But this equipment, Richard gestured at the windmill, can be replicated with a lot less advanced engineering, right?
Bill looked over the assembly, silent for a few moments. Suppose so. Worst case, we could even wind our own armatures for generators, real pioneer stuff.
Richard grinned. Next thing we'll be churning butter.
Butter,
Bill replied. Richard laughed, gave a casual wave, and walked off, whistling the Andy Griffith theme. 86. Planet 4. August 17th. Bill put the panel back onto the portal generator that had been shot by the thugs while Kevin watched.
And done. I think we may have managed to salvage the device. Among their many failures, the morons shot it in the power supply. Those we can get anywhere.
Kevin considered.
We should probably test it.
Bill nodded. Then a slow smile spread on his face.
Yes, we should, Kevin. You know, we could test it by just connecting up to Earth's side.
Kevin looked at Bill quizzically.
But we've done that so many times, Bill continued.
An expression of alarm quickly spread on Kevin's face.
And we do have the pressure vessel, so it would be safe.
Kevin's head began shaking back and forth faster and faster.
And you can't tell me you aren't curious.
Kevin backed away while continuing to shake his head emphatically.
Oh, come on, Kevin. Don't you wonder even a little bit?
Wonder about what?
They both turned to see Monica walking up.
Bill wants to test the portal repairs by trying to find a new Earth, Kevin said.
So what's the holdup?
Bill laughed, while Kevin looked at them both and said,
Oh, God, I'm surrounded by lunatics.
It's okay, Kevin, Bill said. We've got the pressure vessel, like I said. Richard's dead man's switch is a good piece of engineering, though
you didn't hear it from me.
We just have it on for a second or two. Kevin looked back and forth between Bill and Monica, then slumped, defeated.
Okay, but if anyone asks, I'm telling them you threatened me.
Bill and Monica both laughed and they started setting up. Bill moved the pressure vessel into position while Kevin disassembled the pole cam. In a half hour or so, they had everything set up, and the video image on the tablet showed a deactivated gate.
Should we stand outside the shed?
Kevin asked.
Honestly, if we end up destroying the shed, I think I'd rather go up with it, Bill replied.
Somehow, Kevin managed to look even more alarmed.
Enough jawing, Monica said. Push the button, damn it.
Bill smiled at her, held up the tablet, and pressed OK. There was the usual momentary blurring, then the video showed an image of dense forest.
Maybe more like jungle,
Monica said in response to the unspoken thought.
There are a lot of ferns and vines in there.
As they watched, an animal entered the field of view. It was bipedal, about 4 feet tall, with bright patterned plumage in a predominantly red pattern. It also had taloned forearms and sharp teeth.
You've got to be kidding me, Bill said.
Is that
a velociraptor?
It just might be,
Monica replied, awe in her voice. She and Bill exchanged grins.
Guess what we're doing next?
That's it,
Kevin said.
I quit.
End. This has been an Audible Original Publishing production of Outland, Book 1 in the Quantum Earth series, written by Dennis E. Taylor, performed by Ray Porter.
Executive producers, Steve Feldberg and Mike Charzik. Producer, Chelsea Pita. Copyright, 2019, Dennis E. Taylor. Sound recording copyright, 2019, by Audible Originals, LLC. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.